This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Daniel Schorr did his first radio broadcast in 1948, so tomorrow he can mark six decades in broadcast journalism. He spent much of that time at CBS News, where he covered the start of the Cold War, the dawn of the space age, and most famously, Watergate. He was one of Murrow's boys, the last reporter hired by Edward R. Murrow, then became the first editorial employee at Ted Turner's fledgling cable news network. He's worked as NPR's senior news analyst for many years now. He writes commentaries for All Things Considered and Weekend Edition Sunday and parses the news of the week every Saturday morning with Scott Simon. A collection of his commentaries from 1991 to 2007 is just out called Come to Think of It, Notes on the Turn of the Millennium. Later in the program, a look ahead to the people and trends to watch in music this coming year. It's part of our series, The Next Big Thing, that we're running all this week. But first, if you'd like to talk with Dan Schorr about his career, your favorite of his commentaries, or his perspective on the world, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Daniel Schorr joins us here in Studio 3A. And Dan, Happy New Year.
All right, Happy New Year, and delighted to be here.
And it's not often you can surprise Dan Schorr, but he walked into the studio and listened to the billboard, the opening of this program, and said he hadn't heard that particular cut of tape for quite some time. We have a slightly longer version of it. This, again, for those of you who just joined us, is Dan Schorr, a reporter, correspondent then for CBS News, waiting on the steps outside the Justice Department?
No, waiting outside the Senate caucus room.
And they were handed copies of President Nixon's famous enemies list. Dan Schorr reading the list live on TV, no preparation.
15, Stuart R. Mott of Mott Associates, described as nothing but big money for radically left candidates. That is Mr. Mott, who is a General Motors heir and a philanthropist. 16th, Congressman Ronald Dellums of California, who is black. 17th, Daniel Schorr of the Columbia Broadcasting System in Washington. The note here is a real media enemy.
And, Dan, I have to note that there was not a raised eyebrow there, or not a little cock of the head to the camera, no reaction at all.
No, I'm very proud of that. This may have been the most electrifying moment in all my 70 years career in journalism. It was to stand there in front of a live camera talking about what was going on in the Senate Watergate hearings inside, and somebody came up to me and said, here's a copy of the enemies list that John Dean has just talked about. And I said, let's go to the air. And I went on the air without having a chance to look at it. And there was a thing which was marked at the top subject on screwing our political enemies from John Dean. And then it went down to that list, which you've heard. And when I came to my name, I could almost not believe it. It was quite electrifying. And all I know is I said to myself, sure, you got to act as though it's somebody else you're talking about. You can't collapse on television. And so I just stood there, read it, and read the next name and said, back to you now, and collapsed.
Being live on television, being live on broadcast, it's a big surge of adrenaline to begin with. That must have felt like a rush to the heart.
Yes. It's not something I would like to do every day.
You've spent most of your broadcast life, all of those decades, almost all of them, as a reporter. How, when, and why did you make the switch from reporting the news to becoming a news analyst?
That's interesting. I think it is possibly a function of advancing age at 91. I mean, I used to run around and try to get stories and break stories, not as many as Cy Hirsch or Woodward and Bernstein, but I was very interested in being something of an investigative reporter. But that's very strenuous. You got to go places and run places and get on airplanes and so on. And so when in 1985 I left CNN and was offered a job at NPR, when we discussed what the job would be, it would be, you will be our senior news analyst. And that kind of seemed to fit, because a senior analyst doesn't have to run around a great deal. I read a lot of papers and magazines, even a book now and then, talk to people on telephone, and then spend some time, a certain amount of time, just simply thinking. I find that that is not very strenuous, and I enjoy it, and it keeps me alive.
As you looked back on the commentaries that you included in this new collection, and there are, you know, dozens and dozens of them in this, commentaries tend to be, what, 800 words or so?
That's about right, 750.
Uh-huh. And then you've selected, what, five or six from each year from 1991
to 2007. Yeah, I didn't select. The understanding was the offer was made by Viking Penguin, the publisher. I wouldn't have thought of doing this book, but they said, we think people would like to know what you said in recent years about big events as they were occurring. I said, you think anybody would care? So much time has passed. They insisted there was a book there. I was delighted to be convinced of that. And then we simply got out all the transcripts, bunches and bunches of them, and let them do the cutting. I simply said, just do me one favor. If you have to make a selection anyway, try to select out the ones in which I was hopelessly wrong.
They did a pretty good job, but there, inevitably, there are those where you just want to smack your forehead.
Well, that's right.
The inevitability at this point of that there would be universal health insurance back in the early days of the Clinton administration.
That's exactly right, yes. Now, if you ask you what is the one that struck me and made me gape when I read it over again, which I hadn't for a long time, it was simply the commentary when the Supreme Court kind of handed the election to Bush, and I was asked to comment on it. And I said, well, the Supreme Court junta has acted. The Gang of Five have elected the president. Mm-hmm. I heard from some people about that.
I wonder. Well, let's hear from some people as well. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Our guest, of course, Daniel Shore, author of the newly published Come to Think of It, Notes on the Turn of the Millennium. And let's see if we can get Joseph on the line. Joseph with us from, where are you? Lodi in California.
Yes, sir. Hey, hello, Mr. Shore.
Hi.
Your commentary on this current administration is pretty blunt. Do you get feedback from that? It's like you say the things that a lot of people should be, or the mainstream media should be pointing out. You know, have you made the enemy list, I guess?
The thing is, if there is an enemies list, you don't get to find out about its existence until several years later. So I don't know. I don't think I'm a great favorite reporter in this White House or anywhere in this administration. My mail, however, whereas it used to be during Watergate and other days, it would be split between those who liked it, but those who hated it and hated me and thought I was unpatriotic, especially when I publish a report on the CIA, which they had decided to suppress, and it was a very mixed bag. Now that I'm simply quietly analyzing from my desk, I have found that almost all the mail I get is favorable. People say, we like it, keep it up. I think they're rather impressed with the fact that I'm doing it at a fairly advanced age. Something has happened. I don't think I make people mad anymore. Except those who don't call in.
I live in a little tiny town called Lodi, and I have a store here, and there's a little little town coffee shop. And for about a year, I talked to this guy named Milo, and we would talk about politics and stuff. And one day he says, "Well, Joseph, you know," he says, "Well, what is your name?" I said, "I'm Joseph." He said, "I'm Milo Radovich." And I'm going, Milo, where have I heard that name before?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and I've been talking to this guy for about a year, and he just recently passed away.
Yes, he did.
That's right. Now you want to, or should we tell what we're talking about now?
I'm sorry?
You have to tell us who Milo Radovich is. Dan and I both remember, but do you know the story?
There was, I guess, the movie wasn't based on Milo Radovich, but he was the... He was the Air Force pilot with the Serbian father, and the McCarthy tried to take him down for the most part.
That's right.
And he basically stood up for what most Americans should do and call, you know, a spade a spade.
That's right.
And was eventually vindicated.
Reinstated by the Air Force. And that, I think, viewed in history, was the beginning of the downfall of Joe McCarthy.
Hmm. Yeah. And you know, you meet this little 5'5" guy, very unassuming, and every morning he'd have his coffee, and we'd all tell our jokes and stuff and talk about nothing. And it took me about 6 months to say, Milo Radovich, who is that? Where have I heard that name before, once or twice?
It's a Yugoslav name.
Yeah, really? I thought he was Irish. But yeah, it was very fascinating with the people you come across in these little areas that just change history so So incredibly so.
Well, thanks very much for the call, Joseph.
Delighted to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
Happy New Year. We mentioned those times where Dan Shore may have gotten a thing or two wrong. I just wanted to read this brief excerpt from a commentary he did in 1993. Ambassador Robert Oakley, expert on terrorism, told me that the Afghan War did for militant Islam what the Spanish Civil War did for the communists. It gave the veterans an esprit de corps, it radicalized them, and gave them a sense of further mission. And with the Soviets gone, the freedom fighters' mission now turns westward. Got a thing or two right, too.
Yeah, I'm afraid it turned out right.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is Cy. Cy's with us from Cleveland.
Hi, and God bless you and long may you wave. I just wanted to ask you, Frank McGee and Morley Safer were early opponents of the Vietnam War in the media. Who do you recommend now for being courageous in opposing this war?
That's interesting. I wouldn't know. I really wouldn't know. It really was Morley Safer. I won't say Morley Safer opposed the war. Morley Safer did a lot of very good reporting, the net effect of which was to maybe help to shorten the war.
Call into question U.S. policies.
Yes.
Wasn't he? Didn't he have the famous piece of we had to burn the village to save it?
Yes, the Marines with a Zippo lighter setting hatches of fire. And saying we had to destroy this village in order to save it. That's right. Mm-hmm. That was a Morley Safer story, and a great story too. As to who today, gee, I don't know. I think that the administration is so clever at manipulating the press nowadays that I can't think of anybody who's making his career today on pointing out what the government is doing that's wrong.
Thanks very much for the call, Cy. We're talking with Daniel Shore. His new book is called Come to Think of It, Notes on the Turn of the Millennium. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with NPR senior news analyst Daniel Shore. In addition to his duties writing commentaries for All Things Considered and parsing the news with Scott Simon on Saturday mornings, other commentaries for Weekend Edition Sunday, Dan has long held a role here known by the unofficial but very important title of Broadcast Buddy. Dan and I have spent years where we saw more of each other in Studio 2D than either of us spent with our wives.
True.
And we hosted any number of live events. They've got a number into the thousands of hours, Dan Shore. And shortly after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in August of 1990, we co-hosted a series of broadcasts
yes.
Of the Defense Department briefing and a State Department briefing, which tended to come early on in the afternoon. It developed into something of a regular habit, and eventually, after I got kicked out of the show and got sent to Saudi Arabia, Dan Shore made it a regular show.
From National Public Radio in Washington, the expanded coverage of the Gulf War and its aftermath continues now with what has become our daily call-in program, started as a way of providing information, answering questions raised by the war, and continues now apparently because it's popular with many of the NPR stations, and especially I'm delighted to hear with those who call in and hear explanations of things long to be explained.
And that program, in many ways, the predecessor of Talk of the Nation.
Exactly. I was about to say that.
Dan Shore started that program. And what was it like going on the air every day and taking calls from listeners?
Well, after a while, that became very normal. And when it stopped, it said, what do I do now this afternoon? I have an afternoon free. But it was really marvelous. I remember again, it started with my getting a call at 6 o'clock one morning saying that we've invaded Panama. I said, great. So what do you want from me? Said, well, nobody understands why Bush would want to invade Panama. And we thought maybe if you would come in, we'll get you and somebody else, and we'll invite people to call and ask about it. I said, oh, okay. And so there we were, in what indeed were the seeds of Talk of the Nation.
Here's an email we got from Adrian in Portland, Oregon. Thanks for having Mr. Shore on. And Mr. Shore, thank you for all your reporting. My question is this. Do you think that media objectivity is possible? And if so, do you consider it desirable?
I think that it depends what part of the media you talk about. If you're talking about news reporting, I think it is possible to be objective. But then there's another side, that is the columnist. the person who writes essays and tries to tell you what it all means. I don't think that is or necessarily should be entirely dispassionate. I think you want to know what filters through the mind of somebody who may have more information about it than you have and can come up with conclusions that may help you to understand it.
An email from Elizabeth in San Jose, California. My father, Mike Handler, was a colleague of Dan Shore's in post-World War II Europe. Although my father's been dead for more than 20 years, hearing Dan's voice and recollections has kept me in touch with him and that world. Dan, good luck and keep reporting.
And thank you very much. Mike Handler was a wonderful reporter and a great friend.
What was it like reporting from Europe in those days?
Oh, it was wonderful. For one thing, you understand we're living technologically in those days. There are not satellites. You can't do anything live from here to there and so on. I can remember, for example, one of the big stories we had to cover was August 13th, 1961, when they began building the wall in Berlin. And it was very difficult to get that story on because you had to film it and do a stand-up and do all the rest of it. And then I had to be flown to Frankfurt, flown another plane from Frankfurt to New York and hope that it gets there in time. And so it was really, in some ways, it was quite disconcerting to be there with the biggest story that was available at that time, but the people in the United States wouldn't know about it for real for another 24 hours.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Tom. Tom calling us from Chicago.
Mr. Short, it's an honor to talk to you.
My honor.
I have a question for you. What was it like to work for Edward R. Murrow?
Oh, that's a good, that's a wonderful question. And thank you, cousin, for having given it to me. No. Ed Murrow, let me tell you this little story which may reveal more than just generalization. Ed Murrow presided at the end of every year on a program called Years of Crisis, an hour-and-a-half discussion with all the correspondents who had been called home to discuss what had happened in the world in the past year. I had just been stationed in Moscow and had been there for a few months and was called back to appear on the program with great and famous people like Howard K. Smith and David Shundran and all of these people. I was so overcome by the company I was keeping, wondering whether I could measure up to it. And so we did our show, and when it was all over, we were sitting around the semicircle. Murrow was the inside of the semicircle, walked up to each correspondent and said something to him. Then he walked up to me as I was sitting there, standing over me, and looked at me and said, "Sure, you'll do." And that bit of Churchillian understatement was for me a treasure thing which I remember to this day. Hmm. He was the conscience of CBS. If any time I wasn't sure what was right, not right about doing that, I'd go in, "Ed, can I chew your ear about something? Do you think about it?" So on and so forth. And we would all take him as being the person who was the standard that we tried to meet.
Did you see the movie Good Night and Good Luck?
A couple of times.
What did you think of it?
I thought it was beautiful, wonderful. Hmm.
Thanks very much for the call, Tom. Here's an email we have from Dick in Tucson, Arizona. Having been reporting all these years, do you ever find it frustrating to see how history repeats itself?
No, I don't find it. On the contrary, it is when history repeats itself, I have the job then of explaining how it repeats itself and why it repeats itself. History repeating itself is simply, to me, raw material for another commentary.
I have to ask you a question. As you know, there are all kinds of disclosure laws covering various types of documents that will be unclassified after X many years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, whatever it is. I wonder, as I was reading this book, I kept coming across these stories that you got. Yes, the famous report on the CIA, and here's a story you got on page 77 of President Ford mentioning that, they shouldn't press the CIA investigation too hard because they might find out other things even worse than the things they're investigating,
right?
Like what the Times editor asked, like assassination, snapped the president, but he said that's off the record. The Times respected that. You got the story another way and reported it. That's, of course, in the past. Can you give us the sources of that information in 25, 50 years?
Oh, no. Sources today, tomorrow, or yet to come. That's a no-no. You're testing me, aren't you?
Well, no. It's you know, at that point, it's historical information. Wouldn't it be nice to know that somebody in the administration was, in fact, leaking against somebody? It would tell you something important.
In 1948, I was covering Indonesia. there is a relevance that you'll see.
Okay.
I was in Indonesia covering the on-again, off-again peace negotiations between the Dutch and the Indonesian Republicans. Right. There was a committee representing the United Nations called the Good Offices Committee, which was to try to bring them together and didn't succeed. And in the end, two members, but not the third, which was a violation of their rules, submitted a proposal for what to do about it. And mm-hmm. that is, it was supposed to be very, very confidential. I learned of it. I reported it on the air. The Dutch suspended negotiations, went back to the United Nations, and there was a big argument there, which I, in a sense, have provoked. I have had people, historians, since that time, and mind you, I'm talking about 1948.
Mm-hmm. While
ago. And what I can tell you is everybody connected with this, is they're all dead. And yet, when I was meeting somebody who was a historian about Indonesia, and he said to me, I'd die to know where you got a copy of that proposal which torpedoed those negotiations. Could you tell me? I said, well, how many years have passed? 50? Give me another few. It is something quite impossible for me to do, not in a very concentrated way, but it is just viscerally, I can't name sources.
Even open this envelope 50 years after I'm dead?
Well, I hadn't thought about that because I wasn't really thinking in terms of being dead, but I'll think about that.
All right. I'm sorry to bring up the subject, Dan. Let's see if we get some more callers on the line. This is Evan. Evan with us from Goshen in Indiana.
Hi, Neil, and really happy to have a chance to talk with Dan Shore. I think your last guest got me wondering about Dan's projection for 2008, wondering if he has any thoughts about the impeachment movement and whether Congress will step up to the plate with both reviewing or opening up the topic of impeaching Bush and Cheney.
Yes, I know there is a small movement afoot to try to do that. I don't think it has very far to go, even if the House Judiciary Committee were interested in pursuing that. By the time they got it straightened out, and by the time the administration would be gone before they were able to really mount a real impeachment investigation. So in the first place, you really can't do it from this late start, one year to go. And so I don't think it's going anywhere.
First person.
Any thoughts about the importance of it or validity of it in terms of passing on unprecedented powers of the presidential office, the executive office? President?
Reminds me of one day when Vice President Dick Cheney had to go into the hospital on Saturday morning for another checkup of one of us or some another, and I was on the air, and I had lived then, but will repeat now. I said, so Vice President Cheney will be out of office for the next 3 hours while he's having his procedure done. But don't worry, he's passed on his powers to the president.
Evan, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
So, let's see if we can get, this is Bobby. Bobby with us from Waterloo in Wisconsin.
That's right.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Shore, I had the great pleasure of meeting you in Denver in 2000, and in 2000 when you spoke at a conference of mine.
Yes.
And I wanted to know if you could tell us, of all of the wonderful stories you have reported on in your 60 years in the business, if there is a story that you knew about that you didn't report that you regret not reporting.
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yes, there is one. It's a long and very story, which I'll try to shorten for you because we don't have unlimited time. I was in Poland on a CBS assignment doing a documentary about Poland after Stalin. That was 1959 or so. And we were roaming around the country with a car, camera, crew, producer, getting just pictures to indicate what Poland was like. We came to a small town near the Soviet border and suddenly saw a horse-drawn cart piled up with possessions of several people who were following in another cart. I went up to them and said, where are you going? In Yiddish, which was the only language we had in common. And they said they were going to Israel. I said, how come? What? We get on a train to Vienna and then we go to Israel. I said, they are letting you leave to go to Israel? They said, yes. And so I went back to Warsaw and went to see my friend, the Israeli minister, and said, hey, I've met some people who said they're going to Israel. I thought that the Soviets would, then the Poles wouldn't allow Jews to leave because they didn't want to upset the Arabs. He said, you actually saw them and you talked to them and you interviewed them on film? I said, well, if you know this much, I will tell you the rest, and then, Mr. Shore, you decide what you want to do. What has happened is that at the end of the war, the Soviets annexed a piece of Poland. And in the peace with the next, there was a couple of 100,000 Jews living who didn't want to be part of the Soviet Union. The Soviets agreed with the Poles and the Israeli government that they would allow them to be, quote, repatriated, unquote, from the Soviet Union to Poland, but with the understanding they wouldn't stay in Poland, but would go on to Israel. The only thing is, the Soviets said, it has to be secret. If it gets out, the deal is off. And so now I had this film, had this perfectly good story, would have been very interesting, but conceivably would have consigned a couple of 100,000 Jews to beings in the Soviet Union. It was one of those things which I wrestled with and wrestled with, and in the end didn't do, and went and told Murrow that I'd killed my own story, told him the story, and he said, I understand.
Thanks very much for the call.
Yes, thank you again.
We're talking with Daniel Shore, his new book, Come to Think of It. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can get, this is Don. Don's with us from Kent, Ohio.
Hi. I just wanted to call and say thanks for your reporting all these years. I was an Air Force officer pilot stationed on Kadena, Okinawa in my first assignment. And it was quite lonely, you might say, being that far away from home for my first tour of duty.
Mm-hmm.
And the Armed Forces Radio Network carried a broadcast of your reporting, and it was some very strange hour of the day, but I used to always make myself available to a radio at that time, and it really helped keep my sanity there. So I just wanted to say thank you.
Well, that's the nicest thing that's been said to me all week.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
And Don, Happy New Year. Thanks for the call.
Okay, bye.
All right, let's see if we get one last caller in. This is Ron. Ron's with us from Syracuse, New York.
What a great pleasure it is to be talking to Mr. Shore. Mr. Shore, you're extremely competent and eloquent in a demanding profession at an advanced age, and I think what a lot of people would love to know is, how does it feel to be working at your age, and do you have any advice on how to stay vital and relevant into your later years?
Well, I'll tell you, for me, my position here at NPR is simply the perfect thing for me. It doesn't take a lot out of me physically and gives me a reason for getting up every day and doing so. I don't know what I would do if I were not here, but don't tell that to my bosses.
Well, everybody enjoys you, and keep it up. You're great.
Thank
Ron,
you.
I have to tell you a story. Every time I go past the WESAT board, that's the program whiteboard where they write out the pieces for that day's that week's show, and I always tell them, you know, I just want to make sure there's something worth getting up for on Saturday morning. But when I see Dan Shore's name there penciled in on the news of the week in review, I know it's always worth getting up on Saturday morning. Ron, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
All right, Dan Shore, thank you so much for being with us today.
A great pleasure.
Daniel Shore's new book is called Come to Think of It: Notes on the Turn of the Millennium. You can hear him as NPR's senior news analyst on All Things Considered on Weekend Editions Saturday and Sunday. Stay with us. When we come back, we'll begin a week-long series on the next big thing. We're starting with music. Bob Boylan from All Songs Considered will tell us about what's ahead in music and the music business. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.